You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's right to farm law was a flashpoint in a recent debate over the state's livestock siting rules. We'll break down what it is and how Wisconsin's law compares to similar laws across the country. First, southwestern Wisconsin has dealt with heavy flooding in recent years, and storms last August took a major toll for people living in the Kickapoo River and Coon Creek watersheds. A new project from the Driftless Writing Center is collecting stories from residents about their experiences during that flood and how communities came together to recover. Stories from the Flood has a goal of 200 stories. Tomorrow evening, people can hear some of what's been collected so far at a celebration of resilience that's being held at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. Tamara Dean is an author whose books include The Human-Powered Home. She's a board member for the Driftless Writing Center. Tamara, thanks so much for coming up to the studio today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is a part of the state that was hit with a lot of floods in recent years. But last year, give us a sense of how severe this one was.
It was. I mean, we've had, depending on how you count them, 6 or 7 100-year floods in the last 12 years. But on August 27th of 2018, the rain just kept coming and coming, and some villages received 13 inches of rain. This one was unusual, too, because some of the flood control dams that had been built in the last part of the last century broke. So all this water caused the edges of the berms to dissolve, basically, and all this water came downstream.
We saw this in the news as it was happening, of course. We've talked some about the recovery. What led you and your colleagues to want to collect these firsthand accounts of people's experiences?
Yeah, you know, some of us on the board were helping with cleanup in the days after that terrible flood. And we thought, you know, we're happy to mop and to haul away refuse, but we'd like to do something more for people. And what the Driftless Writing Center does the best, really, is help people tell stories. And we also knew about the research that shows when people tell their stories, they begin to heal and move forward. So we thought, okay, we can collect people's stories and be listening ears for people who want to share their stories and help them move through it.
As you started to ask people to recount their experiences, did you get a sense that there was a hunger to be heard and to relive this and share it with other people? Relive might be the wrong word.
Right. I don't know if there's a hunger to relive it, but we definitely, you know, it depended on the person, but in a lot of cases, people were very eager to share the details of their experiences. You know, first we conceived this as a writing project. So we hosted all these workshops in libraries in Vernon and Crawford counties mainly. And yet we found pretty quickly that people either weren't comfortable with writing or would actually rather talk. So it's turned into more of an oral history project. But yes, I definitely think that people feel a little lighter when they leave and they're happy to make it known what they experienced.
You let us get a preview of some of the excerpts from this that you'll be sharing at this event. And I got to say, this is pretty powerful stuff, these firsthand accounts. It is a little different than reading about it in the paper the day after.
It really is. We heard some things over and over, and I guess they shouldn't surprise us, but many people are still processing what happened. And part of that is, you know, whenever it rains, they're anxious. They don't sleep the night if there's a thunderstorm, or some people will just leave their homes if it's raining more than an hour. We also heard a lot of stories about gratitude and humility and the communities coming together, which also shouldn't surprise us here in the Midwest and Wisconsin. But those were some of the themes, and some of those are reflected in the book.
I wanted to focus in on that point a little bit because there is a lot of talk about loss, what people lost, their homes entirely, their possessions, things like that. But there is a lot of talk about how this pulled people together. Can you talk more about the kind of things you've heard?
Yeah, I mean, we've heard amazing stories about first responders who drove hours to help people get out of the floodwaters on that night that they had to evacuate. And then we also heard about different sports teams at high schools who weren't affected coming in to help people empty their homes the day after. You know, a lot of people who are living by the rivers might be elderly or they might have difficulties moving around, so they really did need help. We all needed help because so much was destroyed in that flood.
Just little stories, too. Like there's one, somebody said they had to sell their, I think it was an electric piano, to raise money to replace some of their stuff. And the person who bought it heard their story, paid full price, and threw in an extra $100 just to help out. It's amazing little stories like that.
Right. There's so much generosity and compassion that follows a disaster like this. But, you know, once you get past the cleanup and this community outpouring of goodwill, we still have to deal with the consequences, and that's where this stage of grieving moves along, and maybe we're left alone or we experience an incident that makes us relive like another storm. And this year, we've had so much rain. The rivers are still high. The ground is still saturated, and farmers have had difficulty getting their crops in back in the spring. So we don't feel like we've put this behind us.
Talking to Tamara Dean from the Driftless Writing Center, looking at their project, Stories from the Flood, collecting firsthand accounts from people affected by a huge flood last summer. Tamara, a lot of ambivalence about a place that people clearly love, the rivers they love, the landscape they love, and people asking themselves, can I stay here? Do I trust the river? Can you talk about some of the love/fear people have now?
Yeah, that's a big component. A lot of people who are living by the rivers, their families have been there for generations. And something that I don't think a lot of people understand about last year's flooding was that people who didn't even live in the floodplain and had never been affected by all those 100 or 500 year floods previously were affected by this flood. So they saw no reason to get flood insurance or to move to higher ground. But all those conversations are going on now. It is just torturous, you know, to try to figure out where do you go from here for both the communities and the individuals. But also, a lot of people have their whole life savings in their home. And if they don't get a buyout, you know, they're sort of stuck. So it's not a matter of moving at a whim.
Right. You were touching on this earlier. This is not a piece of history for people. They're still living with trying to figure out, in some cases, how they're going to financially recover from last year's flood.
Right. And, you know, we did get grants from FEMA and from different programs at the state and county levels. But obviously, that can't cover all of people's expenses. And with more and more disasters happening around the nation, the FEMA money, at least, the federal money, is getting stretched thinner. So communities are coming together and beginning those discussions about resilience. What is the best use for that land along the river? And can it be spun in a positive way if we don't have homes there? Is this a place where floodwaters can collect and keep them from, you know, affecting other parts of the community? Is it, you know, a wetland or something?
You have this celebration of resilience coming up tomorrow. Is that right? Can you talk about what you're hoping to come out of this event?
Yeah, that's right. Tomorrow, Thursday, November 7th, we're going to have an event at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve Visitors Center, which is just north of the village of Lafarge along Highway 131 for anybody who hasn't been out there. It's a great place. We're inviting people who told us their stories. We're inviting partners, including the library systems in our area, and the general public to join us and to get a copy of this booklet that collects the narrative excerpts and some photos from our project, and also to share their own stories. We'll have a few speakers, including Brad Steinmetz, who's a local historian from Lafarge, and Dr. Caroline Druschke here from the UW-Madison. She and her students have been helping us out on the project, and give a shout out to them because it's just been amazing to have a partnership with the university on this.
I was looking at all the places that the people in this pamphlet were from, and then I went over to maps online. This covered, a bigger area than I had remembered at the time. This is a huge swath along a couple waterways.
It really was, all the way from Wilton at the north to Wazika in the south along the Kickapoo River watershed, and, you know, from Coon Valley all the way out to the Mississippi River. People were affected in the low-lying areas. And it happened rapidly overnight. And like I said, in places where they'd never seen floodwaters like this before.
So it's a celebration of resilience coming up. As we wrap up, are people more consciously thinking about the idea of resilience after this flood, whether they're using the word resilience or not?
Yeah, definitely. People are talking about whether individually or as a community, how to withstand the next heavy rains. I don't think that anybody imagines that this won't happen again. So we're planning and villages are working together to come up with solutions.
Tamara, thanks so much for coming up and joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
Tamara Dean is an author and board member for the Driftless Writing Center. She's part of the ongoing project Stories from the Flood. Tomorrow night's event, again, is happening at 6 o'clock at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve Visitor Center. It's free and open to the public. Coming up, we'll hear from an agricultural law expert about what right-to-farm laws are and why they're in Wisconsin and all 50 states, for that matter. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the public portion of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump starts next week. We'll find out who's expected to testify during our look at the week in Washington. First, a debate over changes to Wisconsin's livestock siting rules is on hold after the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection decided not to move forward with them. The proposed changes were about how far farms had to be set back from neighbors and how they managed things like odors and runoff. But another sticking point to come out of the debate was Wisconsin's right-to-farm law. Rusty Rumley is a senior staff attorney with the National Agricultural Law Center. He's an expert on right-to-farm laws nationwide. Rusty, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, in our local news over the last couple of weeks, this phrase right-to-farm law came out a lot. It might have surprised a lot of people. What in general does it mean to have a right-to-farm law in a state?
So, Rob, what a right-to-farm law typically does is if a farm is sued for a nuisance action, it provides a type of defense that the farm could use in those types of circumstances. So it would be, there is an old common law doctrine called coming to the nuisance. And basically what it means is if you move next to something that could be considered to be a nuisance, you know, what are your rights going forward? Should the pre-existing use be allowed to continue, or should the pre-existing use be curtailed in some manner? And what right-to-farm statutes do was they were passed late 70s, early 80s, and they were trying to address that very issue when it came to farming operations.
So the idea is if I move, say, from the city to the country to enjoy the fresh air and I move next to a farm, it makes it difficult for me to sue based on the smell of a farm next door, which shouldn't have been a surprise to me. That's the basic concept these were passed for?
That's the basic concept, yeah. They're trying to preserve farmland. I mean, 70s and the 80s, you start seeing urban centers start vacating. You start seeing more of the urban sprawl. This was usually meant to protect that loss of that valuable farmland in that surrounding areas around municipalities.
I understand every state has some version of this, but is there a lot of variation from state to state?
There's a significant amount of variation from state to state. It generally depends on how prevalent agriculture is to your state economy, on how strong your right to farm statute is. So the strength can vary from fairly weak all the way up to very protective.
And big picture, how does Wisconsin stack up compared to the rest of the country? Obviously, we have a fairly important agricultural sector here.
Wisconsin's, it's in the middle, probably in the lower half of the middle. There are some protections that it provides that are fairly strong, but there are, you know, exceptions to it as well. So it falls in the center range.
What kind of exceptions do stand out to you when you look at Wisconsin's right to farm law?
So one of the Wisconsin is one of those states that requires the farming operation to be there first. Some states have done away with that requirement and just said if a farm has been in operation for a certain period of time, 1, 2, 3 years, et cetera, and they're substantially unchanged, then the farm will be protected. So Wisconsin requires the farmer to be there first, which is more of a traditional version of right to farm. So that's a little bit weaker than some of the other states. But then they've got other provisions that take up some slack.
I understand Wisconsin's law came up after a state Supreme Court case, State of Wisconsin versus Quality Egg Farm. And I guess for people around the country, this got some attention at the time.
This was one of those cases. There's always been, as more and more people moved out of rural areas, one of the driving forces for these laws was the fact that as people moved away, there was less understanding of agriculture. And then you had this coming to the nuisance defense But what it is it was always left to the discretion of the judge whether or not they wanted to apply it. So this was the right to farm statutes were meant to streamline the process and try to create steps. So, you know, if you meet these factors, right to farm protection applies. And if you don't meet one of these factors, then you're not entitled to the protection. So this was one of those cases that, you know, started this interest in the right to farm. But there was a couple of states that had already had right to farm statutes before this case, I believe.
Talking to Rusty Rumley, senior staff attorney with the National Agricultural Law Center. We're talking about right to farm laws. Every state has some version of them. We're talking about how they work and how they work here in Wisconsin. Rusty, one point where things get controversial is, okay, the farm was already there when I move next door to it. Everything's all well and good. But then the farm changes operation. They switch from, I don't know, growing corn to having livestock, or from low-density livestock to a lot more livestock. How do the laws work in those kind of cases?
It depends on your state's law. So Wisconsin doesn't have anything that addresses it specifically. But other states, like Minnesota, has limitations on the number of livestock you can have before you lose protection. In some cases, other states will require additional requirements for livestock operations. So a lot of them will have certain pollution controls or certain setback requirements, and that you have to be in compliance with those in order to be protected by the right to farm. So it really just depends on what your state chose to put into their right to farm statute as far as limitations go.
And how, flesh that out a little bit in Wisconsin. How does that work here with that? The farm was already there, but it changed operation.
So in Wisconsin, they don't really have anything on that substantial change language. They do have stuff in there allowing for zoning, though. So, I mean, if their farm is located in an area close enough to a town, or if you have a county government that's interested in zoning, they can take steps to address whether that's a livestock operation or any other types of farms. I mean, in Wisconsin, there are several cases involving cranberry bogs as well. So these cases tend to resemble more of what types of agriculture you have in your state. So, you know, cranberry bogs are not a very typical situation for most other states out there, but it's something that's unique to Wisconsin.
Now, in practical terms, are there often cases where a farmer has to invoke this right to farm defense, or does it end up working as a deterrent, saying, yeah, don't even bother filing a suit on these nuisance grounds unless you really have something that exceeds the protections under the law?
Typically, it can be both. This is really difficult to tell how much of a preventative measure they have, because there's no way to go out there and gather the data on how many cases weren't filed or how many cases were dismissed before they ever went to a final verdict. So that's something that we've struggled with over the years, is to see just how much impact these statutes really have. I mean, Wisconsin has 5 or 6 cases over 30 years. And that's a
not very often
got right now. Yeah, that's cases that have gone all the way through the trial, and then they have to be appealed up to the state appellate court, and they have to go all the way to a final decision at the state appellate court, and then they're reported. So it's really difficult to say, how many of these cases weren't appealed, or how many of these cases were settled.
Gotcha.
There's no statistics on that, so there's no way to tell.
Now, one concern people have is with the concentration of a lot of the livestock industry, larger scale, denser livestock farms. Some people call them CAFOs. As people are protesting that and challenging these, is that running up against these right to farm laws and leading maybe into some gray areas in those laws?
It can, depending upon the state statute. Some of them specifically address CAFOs in the laws. They either limit the amount of protections or they put additional requirements on them. Other states where the laws haven't been changed as much, they may not reflect those types of situations. So it really depends on the given state.
As we mentioned, every state has some version of a right to farm law. Do we see states going back and revisiting and modifying them over the years, or do they kind of fire and forget? They pass it and then leave it standing?
Oh, no, absolutely. These things get modified over the years. Some states, there's been 4 or 5 states that have changed their laws this past year.
Really?
So, these things can change. Some states will change it more frequently than others. Some states, they passed it early on, and then they may have changed it once or twice in the 30 or 40 years that it's been on the books. But, yeah, these things can change. And typically, they change when a big case comes down.
Are there trends in the kind of changes states make when they revisit these laws?
To give you an example, one of the changes that has been prevalent this year, there was a series of cases out of North Carolina dealing with hog farms, and some of the verdicts in those cases were surprisingly large. I think there's a series of 26 cases. They've had 5 trials so far, and the verdicts have been in excess of $550 million combined. So some of the states have gone back and put damage caps, you know, capping it at the fair market value of the property, since nuisance is more of a property crime. You know, you're not a property tort. You are interfering with someone's use and enjoyment of their property, and you're devaluing their property. So there have been some states going back and putting damage caps on their particular laws, but that's been one of the changes from this year.
Interesting. As we wrap up, what's on the frontier of right to farm laws? What are you watching for maybe the trends in 2020?
We're looking to see if there's going to be any more damage caps out there. And then the other thing is going to be, how do people deal with changes in agriculture? So there is being more concentration out there. How do states handle that going forward? Is it something they wish to address? Is it something that they're going to leave their right to farm law mainly silent on? So that's one of the areas that we're watching going forward.
Rusty, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Mm-hmm. Glad to be here.
That's Rusty Rumley, Senior Staff Attorney with the National Agricultural Law Center. He was with us today to explain how Wisconsin's right-to-farm law works and give us some background on why laws like it have cropped up in all 50 states around the country. Coming up after the news, the House will hold public hearings as part of its impeachment inquiry starting next week. We'll find out what we can expect during our weekly roundup of national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the state Senate has voted for the first time in decades to fire one of the governor's picks to head a state agency. We'll break down what happened and look at some bills that got a vote in the Senate yesterday as well. First, we take a look at the week in Washington. Elections around the country last night saw wins for both Democrats and Republicans. Transcripts of closed-door testimonies are being released by congressional committees, and next week the House will start holding public hearings as its impeachment inquiry moves forward. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Now that this process is moving into a public phase, what are you hoping to see? Will you pay attention to the hearings with U.S. diplomats and others? Have you made up your mind on the issue of impeachment? Do you think public testimony could change your opinion one way or the other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Lauren Gambino is a political correspondent for The Guardian. Lauren, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with Election Day yesterday. Not a lot of states had high-profile elections, but a few did. Let's start in Kentucky with the governor's race there. Close one, still not quite called yet, right? A challenge there. What's going on?
Yes. So the current Republican, Matt Bevin, is calling for, he wants effectively a recount there. It's a razor-thin margin. There's just a few thousand votes separating the Democrat from this incumbent Republican, and he wants to make sure that everything's settled. He obviously isn't ready to concede, but the Democrat, Beshear, has already, claimed victory. He's saying this is, you know, we're moving on from this sort of turbulent chapter in Kentucky history because Matt Bevin was a very controversial governor. He kind of had a lot of enemies, you know, insulted teachers who were protesting cuts to their pensions. He went after Medicaid. So he, by the end of his first tenure, didn't have a lot of friends. So he struggled. Trump did try to help him. That has been a piece of this. So Trump came in, held a rally, even said, you know, please reelect him because if you don't, this is going to reflect badly on me. But that wasn't enough to get him over the line. It did certainly bring him very close, but it appears that he won't be reelected.
Let's give a listen to President Trump speaking in Kentucky, basically on the eve of the election.
You're sending that big message to the rest of the country. It's so important. You got to get your friends. You got to vote, because if you lose, it sends a really bad message. It just sends a bad, and they will build it up. Here's the story: if you win, they're going to make it like ho hum. And if you lose, they're going to say, Trump suffered the greatest defeat in the history of the world. This was the greatest. You can't let that happen to me.
There's always a temptation, Lauren, for a state election that people try to extrapolate to the rest of the country. From what you were saying about the Kentucky governor, people were voting for the Kentucky governor here. This was not necessarily a referendum on anything going on in national politics.
Exactly. And if you look at the rest of the candidates who won statewide, they were Republicans. So people were actually voting for a Democratic governor and then voting down ballot for Republicans, which is a unique element of this race and might suggest that this is, you know, maybe uniquely about the current incumbent, Matt Bevin, who is deeply unpopular. But, you know, then again, Trump did touch on what is true. Everyone is scouring these election results to see what might happen in 2020. And this is a person who modeled himself after Donald Trump. He really embraced the president's style and rhetoric. He's very confrontational and combative. So perhaps, you know, perhaps that does give us some clues as to, you know, maybe voters are getting a bit wary of the style of politics. But it's just one race, and we're still a year away.
And the one, before we move on from Kentucky, one concern for Republicans and maybe the president that some people have expressed is, here's the president trying to come into a close race, have a big last-minute rally, and save the day. And for whatever reason, possibly having to do with the candidate himself, it wasn't enough. Is that something that Republicans are going to be worried about?
Yes, that is a piece of this, especially because because Trump does like to do that. But I think there's other examples from Tuesday night where, he was Mississippi. We'll get to that. But, you know, he was successful. He did go in and try to help the Republican, and the Republican won there. So I think those results are kind of a mixed bag. It's not, you know, there's no clear cut takeaway, I would say, from this. But it is obviously a shock to see a Democratic governor in a state like Kentucky.
And Mississippi, yeah, it seems like it should be a gimme for Republicans. They did win it. But looking at the polling, there were polls suggesting that it was going to be a tight race, giving the Democrat the edge. It didn't come into yesterday looking like a lock for Republicans.
No, and, you know, it was tighter than expected. There was a spirited challenge there. Democrats spent a lot of money on that race, more than they typically have, because they thought they had a chance. But as we said, the Republican candidate did pull it off. The lieutenant governor will now be the governor. I think that speaks to sort of the conservatism prevailing in the Deep South. That's certainly, you know, an enduring trend that we've seen. I think when you look at these races, maybe holistically, where Republicans are starting to get really concerned, and it's something that they've noticed over the past few years, and it's that suburban voters are abandoning the party. They used to be the most reliable constituency for Republicans, and that is no longer the case. And so if you look at different pockets and different districts in these states, you'll see suburban voters that were once conservative are now either voting for the Democrat or less strongly voting for the Republican. And that is a big piece of the 2020 election. And that's where Republicans are really getting concerned. How do we stop this exodus and, at least not lose entirely in 2020? in the suburbs.
And that suburban story is part of the other big election result people are watching, the Virginia legislature flipping from Republican to Democratic control. Democrats made big gains 2 years ago, and now they finished it off by taking control of both chambers of the Virginia legislature. What do you see in there?
Yeah, that was the biggest celebratory story this morning for Democrats. They just are over the moon about their victory in Virginia. And it does mean a lot. You know, Virginia traditionally has been a battleground state. It's obviously much bluer, much more Democratic these days. But now, you know, now they have full control. A lot of the candidates ran on gun control, health care. These are issues they think they can now put forward and advance sort of a more progressive agenda in the state. So they are very eager there. And as you mentioned, it turned on these suburban voters and these suburban districts. Really sort of the candidates focused on it was gun control and it was health care, and that really, you know, that sort of helped put them over the edge. And now they have control ahead of the 2020 census, which is also very important for redistricting. So this was a very big win for Democrats, less predictable.
We're looking at some of the big news in national politics this week. Lauren Gambino is with us from The Guardian. Let's move on to the latest now in the impeachment inquiry. A lot going on there. Some of the news from yesterday, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, revised his testimony, reversing course, people have said, on whether the White House had withheld military aid to Ukraine as a condition of investigating the Bidens. What about Sondland's testimony got people so shook up here?
Yes. So he went back and he updated his impeachment testimony to describe what sounds like quid pro quo is the word that's been used. He said effectively it was his understanding that that Donald Trump and the White House weren't going to give Ukraine military aid until Ukraine promised to look into Donald Trump's political rivals, specifically Joe Biden's son and the company that Joe Biden's son worked for. So, you know, he was laying out what Democrats have accused Trump and the White House of being complicit in, which is a quid pro quo deal based on military aid. He had not previously said that in his initial testimony. So this was, he described it as a refreshing. Since he'd first sat down with the committees, he remembered this based on what other people had come forward to tell the committees. But it was certainly a surprise, especially as he hadn't laid that out initially. And it, you know, it set off just a day of Republicans kind of on the back foot trying to figure out the best defense for the president. Democrats sort of pointing to this as yet another example of what they've been accusing the president of. And so, you know, really this sets us up for next week when you're going to start to have these public hearings.
We're talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent at The Guardian, about the week's news from the nation's capital. We'll pick up with a look ahead at those public hearings. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with the impeachment inquiry moving into public hearings. Are you going to be paying attention? You're going to watch or listen live? Are you happy to see more of the process in the public eye now? Transcripts also coming out from some of the closed-door hearings, redacted for national security reasons. What are you hoping to learn about the Ukraine issue and officials getting called to testify? Is your mind made up? Are you waiting for more information? What do you want to see from Wisconsin lawmakers in the House when it comes to the impeachment process, in the Senate, if it ends up going there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Lauren Gambino, political correspondent for The Guardian, looking at the week's top news in national politics. We're talking about issues related to the impeachment inquiry. Now let's bring on a caller. Carrie is with us in Green Bay. Carrie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Carrie?
Sorry if this is a blatantly obvious question and I'm just missing it, but if they had recordings of Trump saying this, then why is it even considered for an impeachment? Wouldn't it just automatically be a violation?
Carrie, thanks a lot for the call. So there's the partial transcript of the president's call with Ukraine. There's the president's comments to the media about issues with Ukraine that some people say is impeachable. But, Lauren, there's no such thing as an automatic violation, right? It has to go through Congress.
Right. And there is some discrepancy over what, you know, what impeachable offense looks like. Does this rise to the occasion of impeachment? And obviously, Republicans and Democrats are deeply divided over that. But I think the process of impeachment allows you to really get into these questions and to look at all the evidence and both decide, okay, was this behavior appropriate? Is it impeachable? And that's why they're going through this process. So yes, yeah, there isn't, sort of an automatic, you must sort of go through this investigation and then, down the road, perhaps a trial.
Carrie, thanks a lot for the call. Robert joins us now in Toma. Robert, hi.
Hi. Like I was saying, at first I thought Trump was in big trouble this time. But now that I think about it, and as I've learned more through you and other news locations, that, it's just a frivolous mess. And how many foreign countries investigate U.S. citizens and business people that, like the KGB used to back in the Cold War days.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. And Lauren, what people are concerned about is the president, or at least his staff, asking a foreign political leader to make public statements is one of the things that's coming out in these transcripts announcing these investigations. What stands out to you from these transcripts when it comes to what the Trump administration appears to have been looking for from Ukraine?
Well, I think there's this idea that you wouldn't turn to another country to ask them to investigate an American citizen. In this case, those citizens are Democrats and Joe Biden and Joe Biden's son. Those are political rivals. But I think, though Ukraine is an ally, it doesn't. There's a lot of people in the State Department who have testified, other White House officials who think, you don't turn to another country and ask for that. This isn't the office of the presidency shouldn't be used for political requests. It very much should be used to advance U.S. foreign policy and goals that help all Americans, the United States, not just, your political ambitions. So I think that's what's at the center of this debate, whether this, was a request to help Donald Trump politically or if it was, in line with U.S. foreign policy. I think that gets at, some of what makes these this testimony so revealing.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll bring on David now in Wausau. David, hi.
Yeah, hi. I guess what I was originally calling about was I think I'm probably one of the few people that's on the fence about it. I think we need some really solid evidence. We don't need somebody hearsay. What witnesses are currently, the Republicans are saying everybody's just talking about what they heard. Nobody actually heard the phone call. And then they say, here's the transcript. And then the Democrats say the transcript is faked. So I think we just need some really firm evidence. But to further that point in a different direction regarding the last caller and what the guest was saying about investigating political opponents, the issue with that is that it is the president's job to investigate corruption. That's period. The president's job is to fix corruption. If you're going to fix corruption, every single person that's corrupt has some place in politics, right? There's nobody that's a corrupt politician without being a politician first. And so I think if we have that evidence of him doing it because he's particularly because he's running against Joe in the primary, if Joe wins the primary, but because he's running against him, that's a whole different can of worms. But, in regards to investigating dirty politics, you're not going to be able to investigate dirty politics without a politician.
David, thanks a lot for the call. Let's start with hearsay. We're getting a lot of firsthand accounts, and let's turn to the public testimony now. What kind of firsthand accounts are we going to be getting, Lauren?
So There have been people who've testified who were on the call, and that's seen as, you know, a firsthand account to that sort of fateful call in which Donald Trump spoke to the president of Ukraine and asked, indicated that he would like him to possibly look into this. And that was Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, and he has testified before these committees. In public hearing, though, you're going to have people who were involved with shaping Ukraine policy on behalf of the State Department and the administration. So maybe they weren't, you know, firsthand on the call, but they were involved in conversations that are relevant to this investigation. There's a woman, Marie Yovanovitch, who her story is very relevant. She was ousted as ambassador in Ukraine, and that was seen as sort of part of a plan by Rudy Giuliani, who is the president's personal lawyer, because he didn't like what she was doing in the country. He thought it interfered with his own goals with Ukraine. So I think, again, part of what's at issue is what counts as firsthand evidence. But I think we're seeing that this scandal has sort of gone beyond just that singular phone call. And so some of these other people, maybe they weren't on the call, but they are very relevant because they were part of conversations with administration officials about Ukraine, about foreign policy, about the military aid. And so I think you'll see when they come forward in public testimony next week and the weeks after, you'll see their relevance to this investigation.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Lauren Gambino from The Guardian about some of the big news in national politics. Moving to a related issue, talk about the whistleblower who originally raised concerns about the president's July 25th phone call. Senator Rand Paul had this to say at a rally with President Trump, that one in Kentucky we were talking about earlier on Monday.
We also now know the name of the whistleblower. The whistleblower needs to come before Congress as a material witness because he worked for Joe Biden at the same time Hunter Biden was getting money from corrupt oligarchs. I say tonight to the media, do your job and print his name.
Now, there's not a confirmed name out there to release, as I understand at this point. But what kind of reaction is that getting from Senator Paul's Republican colleagues?
His colleagues do not agree with that. Republicans have actually taken action in the past to protect whistleblowers, especially because whistleblowers can come forward with evidence about corruption, of course, but also misspending or all types of wrongdoing in government. And of course, Republicans are very supportive of whistleblowers when they do come forward with certain cases of financial waste, et cetera. So there is a strong opposition to this. I think there's also the sense that it would have a chilling effect on future whistleblowers if they were to publicly identify this person. And there's the legality around it is very gray. The whistleblower's lawyer is really calling on Congress not to do this. They don't, and the media for that matter, they don't want this whistleblower's name out there because he or she is awarded protection. But whether it would be against the law to actually release publicly his name, that doesn't seem to be the case. So there's sort of this two schools of thought about how the media should progress with his name and his identity. And then members of Congress, obviously led by Rand Paul, who does believe that Trump deserves to face his accuser, as they've worded it.
And as we start to wrap up in our last minute or so, a government funding bill. This used to be a broken record here. The Congress needs to pass a funding bill before November 21st deadline. Just briefly, what are the potential sticking points here?
It's again Donald Trump's wall. He really wants funding for that wall. But it does look like they're going to come up with sort of a stopgap solution. So no shutdown over Thanksgiving, possibly again a fight at Christmas time. But it looks like they're going to try to avoid this fight right before Thanksgiving.
And briefly, Lauren, what is on your radar as you look ahead to the next week in Washington?
Oh, well, we've got coming down the pike, we've got another governor's race to look forward to in Louisiana. That will be another test of Donald Trump's support. So that's a week and a half ahead, I think. So we'll be looking out for that.
Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent for The Guardian. She was with us for a look at the week in Washington, some of the biggest stories going on in national politics. You could still let us know what you think about some of the things we talked about, including the impeachment inquiry about to move into its public portion. Are you happy that more hearings are going to be broadcast for the public to see? What are you curious to find out? Who are you interested to hear from? Will you be watching these? Have you made up your mind on impeachment one way or the other? Or do you think you could still be persuaded in one direction or another? Is this on your radar? You can let us know, tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can always email us. Our email address is ideas@WPR.org. If you're looking for a weird off-kilter setting for your new music video, and I know you are, Wisconsin may have the answer for you. And the rock band The Wreck on Tours, featuring Jack White of the White Stripes, took advantage of a unique setting here in the state. As reported in the Wisconsin State Journal, The Wreck on Tours released their new music video for their song Some Days I Don't Feel Like Trying. The setting might look familiar to Wisconsinites and tourists. The video was shot at House on the Rock near Spring Green. The band was in the unusual Wisconsin landmark to shoot the video back in September. It includes exterior shots and some action in the famous Infinity Room and alongside the giant carousel. The video director is a fan of House on the Rock. He says the thing that hooked me in is you can't tell what's real and what's not. House on the Rock has seen a lot of pop culture action in recent years. It's the site of a big scene in the book American Gods by Neil Gaiman and the TV show based on the book. And it gets a reference in the tabletop role-playing game Invisible Sun. Here's a question for you. If you finally started up that rock band you've been thinking about, where in Wisconsin would you film your video? Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time. I've been riding this thing out since I was